Welcome to Work From Your Happy Place, the podcast that equips you with the tools, know-how, and motivation to live your dreams and find your happy place. Be sure to sign up for our free weekly newsletter for a recap of the week's guests and a preview of what's in store. To sign up, simply text the word happy place with no space to 33444. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce the host of Work From Your Happy Place, Belinda Ellsworth.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Work From Your Happy Place, where we interview entrepreneurs who are making a difference and working from their happy place. I'm your host, Belinda Ellsworth, and today I have a really great guest in store for you. I have Steve Lubetkin, who is an award-winning multimedia journalist and veteran PR counselor. He produces news content for several media outlets. He just finished a five-year engagement covering commercial real estate news for GlobeStreet.com. He produces his conference podcasts for NJSpotlight.com. He is accredited in public relations and a member of the Public Relations Society of America's prestigious College of Fellows. He served for 3 years on the PRSA National Board of Directors. But he has also been on the cutting edge in using technology for communications and marketing for a very, very, very long time. In fact, he was the first music writer to use a portable computer to cover a rock concert. It was a Grateful Dead concert in Englishtown, New Jersey in 1977. Wow, it is my pleasure to welcome Steve to our show today.
Thanks, Belinda. It's great to be here.
Yeah, so Steve, let's... You've given us a lot of really great information here, but let's just fill in the gaps of some of this bio and tell us a little bit more about yourself and, more importantly, about your journey.
Sure. I worked in print and broadcast journalism very early in my career while I was in college and then immediately after college, and then switched over to the public relations side of things, worked in corporate PR for almost three decades, and I was what the British like to call made redundant after surviving two large bank mergers in a five-year period. And at that point, I exited the corporate world and decided it was time to do something differently with my career. And fortunately, I was able to draw on my broadcast journalism and reinvent myself as a professional podcast producer. I was one of the first people to actually hang out a shingle and offer to produce podcasts for companies and organizations that wanted to jump into this new kind of medium but didn't know how to do it themselves or didn't want to hire someone to work for them full time doing that.
That's great. And so have you been successful with helping a lot of podcasters do this?
I'm happy to say we have. We've been doing this for 15 years now, although I do like to say to people, I probably can trace my podcasting back to when I was a teenager, which was, as you indicated in the bio, quite a long time ago, when I was bitten by the radio bug at the age of about 15 or 16 and started producing pretend radio programs in my parents' basement using a microphone, a record player, and a reel-to-reel magnetic tape recorder. I would announce the songs, play the songs, and then play back the recording. And at the time, there was no internet. There was no way to distribute them. So it was pretty much playing them back for myself, or if I could convince my best friend to play chess with me, I would make him listen to the shows. So I've been doing it for a long time. And fortunately, the skills I learned in commercial radio back in the dark ages in the 1970s were transferable. I had to relearn how to produce and edit using digital tools, because back then we used analog tools, and then gear up with digital recording devices and additional microphones and cables and all the other stuff. And then within a couple of years of setting up the business for audio podcasting, we started hearing from clients who wanted us to do video. And so we then started gearing up for video. And since that time, we've been producing both audio and video podcasts for corporate clients, trade associations. We have, as you mentioned, news content for several news outlets. We had a fairly successful run of about 27 weeks last year where we produced a weekly audio podcast called the CRE News Hour after I left GlobeStreet, producing a one-hour weekly sort of a radio show, sort of an all things considered for the commercial real estate market, interviewing people, the newsmakers in that industry, and going to trade shows and conferences and covering them, and, you know, producing the show. And unfortunately, it's very difficult to get people to advertise on podcasts. And we can talk about the different business models that people try in podcasting. But we decided to put the show on ice and put it on hiatus for a while we look at other ways to do that.
It is an interesting medium. I know I've been involved with this now for about 2.5 years, almost 3 years. And there's some success in that. But then it's like, then there's the whole monetization of what is success. It's having a certain amount of listeners, but then it's, what are you doing with that? So I learned that, you know, there is a tremendous amount of podcasts out there, but really a very small percentage that have any level of real success. So would you agree with that, disagree with that? And then what would you speak to on the different models of how people are doing podcasts?
Oh, I totally agree. The biggest challenge in podcasting is that advertisers who are willing to consider podcasts tend to be the same people who advertise on traditional broadcast media like television and radio. And those people grew up in a world that was based on something called the CPM model. Now, CPM stands for cost per thousand. The M is the Roman numeral for a thousand. It doesn't work that well in podcasting. The traditional advertising model for a radio station would be, we have X number of listeners, divide that by 1,000 and put a cost on it. And that's where you get the number. Podcasts tend to draw smaller but more engaged, more passionate audiences, but they're not that big. And so somebody who's trying to buy advertising on a CPM basis is looking for much larger numbers. And that sort of skews the advertising towards the programs that are being produced, frankly, by mainstream media companies. And the only difference between them and a broadcast network show is they're putting them out as a podcast rather than putting them over the satellite or over a broadcast transmitter. So the model doesn't work very well for most podcasters like you and me. The other model that people try is the subscription model, where you put out content and ask people to pay either a small fee or a large fee for the content. And depending on what the content is, by and large, most people don't want to pay for it. Mm-hmm. We had a fairly successful podcast we were doing when we first got into the business, and I needed to sort of put on a show for people so they would understand what it was about. And there was a very visible local Chamber of Commerce program, a quarterly business outlook, where they would have multiple business leaders from different sectors on a panel. And it was one of the few programs this particular chamber did as a free program that anybody could come to. And they would get 300 or 400 people every quarter for this program. We started producing podcasts from them. And right at the beginning of the Great Recession, in the end of 2006, beginning of 2007, when things were starting to turn, there was an economist on the panel who was making dire predictions. And that quarter's podcast achieved a very high number of downloads. And of course, we were giving away the podcast like everybody pretty much does. But we looked at the number of downloads and we said, if we charge $2 for this, and even if we lost half of the people who would just say we don't want to pay for it, the other half, if they paid $2, that would be a pretty decent piece of revenue. So we got with the producers of the conference, the chamber, and a local university, and said, can we do this? And they said, sure. But if you get, 100,000 people paying for it, we'd like a cut. And I said, we should be so lucky. We ended up putting a paywall in front of the podcast the following quarter for $1.99. And this is an hour-long program with business leaders from the community. And we went from several thousand downloads literally to zero.
Oh, my goodness.
And so, I mean, it was a lesson. It was an object lesson. And again, I think, you know, we learned that lesson with the 27-week run of the CRE NewsHour. The lesson is people are not interested in paying for your content. The model that we've always worked with, and in fact, the model that I wrote about in the book that I co-authored on podcasting with Donna Papacosta from Toronto, The Business of Podcasting, our model is the production services model. You can make money from podcasting by being a professional podcast producer. It's a lot harder to make money from advertising or subscriptions. It's almost impossible, we believe.
Wow, that's interesting. All right. We're kind of getting off on that. That's okay when I get off of my main questions I was going to ask, but it's all very, very interesting. So a lot of people just basically have their podcast because they enjoy it or it helps them build their brand in other areas. I would say that that's probably us. It continues to give us an awareness, which causes people then to want to find out what else you have to offer. So in that regard, it is still fairly successful for a lot of people.
Well, that's primarily the way most of the clients we work with use their podcast.
Okay.
It's a way of generating interest and promoting their knowledge and expertise or thought leadership. We work with some very large business-to-business global companies who are interested in demonstrating that their executives have knowledge and expertise that can be useful to other businesses. So, for example, one of the companies, I use this example because it really shows the effectiveness of podcasting for large businesses. It was a global insurance company selling risk management services to other large companies, not auto, home, life, and health insurance, the traditional kinds of insurance that we would all buy. Very esoteric kinds of business risks like environmental liability, directors and officers insurance. And so the company was launching a line of insurance to cover companies against cyber liability. This was at the beginning of the time, we're talking about 10 or 12 years ago, when nobody was really aware of how much financial risk they faced if there was a breach of their data security from cyber crime. And so they were beginning to roll out this cyber liability coverage, but they needed to educate people about the risks. And so we did a series of podcasts with the subject matter expert at the insurance company. And these podcasts were not about, we have great claims agents, we're friendly, you know, all of the silly stuff you see in the commercials with lizards and, you know, people in amusement parks and things. It was about practical things that companies need to have in order to protect themselves from cyber liability. And that means knowing how to encrypt your data, knowing how to protect your network with firewalls from intrusion, training your staff to recognize when you're being penetrated by cyber criminals, that sort of stuff. And insurance is a part of that process, but it's not the focal point of the podcast. And so what happened with this was that the company wrote a white paper explaining all of this stuff, because some people like to read white papers, but others like to listen to podcasts. They put up a special landing page for this topic on their website, and there was the white paper and there was the podcast. And then the subject matter expert was able to say to people who contacted him, here's a link, go download the white paper and go listen to the podcast, and you'll be better prepared to talk to me. And he was able to avoid having about 13,000 half-hour conversations over and over again, because people could go listen to the podcast of him explaining everything instead of him having to get on the phone and explain it over and over one at a time.
Okay.
Now, for somebody in a corporation making a corporate vice president's salary, 13,000 half-hours of his time are pretty costly.
Mm-hmm.
So by doing that, they saved the time of him being tied up on the phone, but they also prepared the clients to be better educated and better prepared to discuss the issue. And so when they did come back to him, they said, I listened to your podcast. Now I get it. I'm ready to talk to you. They were predisposed to do business because there's a halo effect that comes from showing your expertise in a podcast in that way. So a lot of the clients we work with use it exactly the way you just described.
Very good. So what do you think that you've identified as a couple of your greatest skill sets that have helped you in your journey of success? And obviously, you've had to adapt along the way, which I think is honestly the hardest thing for a lot of people, to continue to adapt to change, technology, change in culture. And obviously, you've done that successfully. So would you like to share a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's the first thing is getting over the fear of not having that regular income from a salaried position. It's a challenge to start a business. It can be frightening. And I know that when I left the corporate world, I had a bit of a severance package, but that included the opportunity to purchase, for example, medical insurance through the COBRA regulations. And the first time you see the bill for that COBRA insurance, you get a lump in your throat. Mm-hmm. And writing that check was scary. But, you know, once you get over that and you say, okay, I got past that, and then you start bringing in some revenue, it becomes a little bit easier. And then, you know, there's stumbles along the way. I remember when it became time to part ways with a client. At a time early in the process when I only had a few clients, but it was very clear this wasn't going to work out, this relationship. And we mutually agreed to part ways, and there was a significant amount of monthly money coming in from that. And it was, again, with a lump in the throat, you cross your fingers and say, we'll find it from somewhere else. And it becomes easier over time as clients come and go, because they do come and go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think I've been able to be flexible about that. I've been flexible in terms of pivoting to try a particular approach to a product and see if it works, and then realizing that it's not working, and finally, you know, cutting the losses, if you will, and moving on to do it in a different way. You learn how to do your own billing and invoicing in ways that are more cash flow effective for you. You learn to price and negotiate your contracts in certain ways. It can be challenging, but it's also very rewarding. At the end of the day, I like to say to people, you know, I know when I walk into the office in the morning, there won't be a memo announcing a reorganization and I'm out of a job.
Absolutely. Which definitely then speaks to a little bit about the lifestyle that you've been able to create in having your own business.
Yeah, it's been very fulfilling. I get to spend a lot more time with my wife and our cats. We have two adult daughters who are both in relationships. One daughter's married, one's with her boyfriend, and we get to see them on whatever timetable they need. I have one of my daughters married to a commercial contractor who helped me build a TV production studio in my basement. So I am actually able to do quite a bit of production from my home, and I don't have to go out as much as I used to. The technology of the internet that we're using today lets me do interviews with people all over the world and produce podcasts for clients from all over the world.
It is pretty amazing, isn't it?
It's wonderful.
Absolutely. So let's talk about an outstanding accomplishment or something that's been super meaningful for you in all of this.
Yeah, I've been particularly proud of the recognition we've received in recent years. You know, as I mentioned earlier, I started my professional career in radio and print journalism. I was a radio newscaster and production engineer, and I reported for several local newspapers. And then going into corporate PR and coming back out, I reignited my interest in daily journalism. I'm doing some journalistic audio and video programs for corporate clients, for both media clients and for our own account. And we've submitted some of that work for recognition in journalism competitions, and we've won a number of awards, which it's particularly satisfying to win awards for doing video news stories when you actually never worked in broadcast television.
Right.
And yet my peers in the industry, journalists who work in television, who are judging the stories that are submitted, give us prizes for them. And that makes me really happy. So it means I'm on the right track.
Absolutely. And that is, congratulations on that. That is exciting.
Thanks.
Yeah, for sure. How about a challenge or obstacle that you faced, and then how you worked through it?
Well, you know, most of the obstacles are technical. And one of the things that you learn fairly quickly when you're on your own is that when a client asks you, can you do something, the automatic answer is, of course. Mm-hmm. And then you go and find out how to do it, even if you've never done it before. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to agitate the client, you know, by saying, well, I don't know, we have to check, and, you know, just the best thing to do is say yes and find, if you have to, you pay somebody who has the skills to help you do what you need to do. But often you can learn the skills and then show your client and become a hero. And so there was one instance where one of my podcasting clients decided they wanted to do a video for the first time. And we did the video in a local university's television laboratory. They had an actual TV studio on campus that was being used by the TV students, the students who were studying television. They let us use the studio, and we set up our cameras and we recorded the video. And in the editing process, the client noticed that there were some logos that appeared on the set that were logos of the school, basically. Mm-hmm. And they asked us if we could blur the logos. Now, if these logos were just static images alongside the talking head, it would have been easy to do. But because of where they were located, it was a complicated special effect. And in order to do it, it meant first buying an expensive upgrade to the software we were using for editing, and then spending a week or two learning how to use that tool to create the effect that was needed.
Okay.
So that was a real challenge. Most of the challenges now are around, when we get to a venue, are we going to have what we need to produce a good recording? Frequently we work with a third party, for example, if we're at a restaurant or a catering hall or something, mm-hmm. they have their own audio visual people working the sound, and we have to make sure that we can tap into their sound system. And a lot of times the sound systems in different venues are surprisingly limited.
Yep.
So we always bring the technology we need to back up when we're doing things like that. So, you know, we can always reach into a bag of tricks and pull out a cable or pull out a mixer or wireless microphones and generally save the day. So, you know, after 15 years, there's not too many things that surprise us, but there's always something around the corner.
Always, right?
Yep.
I know my husband's a recording engineer, and even in speaking in different locations, when I'm on the road, it's like a lot of times, and then the hotels, they don't even have anybody that knows how to troubleshoot anything, and he'll end up troubleshooting the hotel's situation.
Sure.
And that's not uncommon. So
the worst ones, and I'm sure you've encountered them, are the hotels where there's not even a sound mixer in the room. There's just a microphone on a stand and a cable that plugs into a plug in the wall.
And I would say to you that that is a good majority. It's a bigger amount than what people would actually realize.
Yeah, and it's surprising in this day and age, even in venues like colleges and universities where students are using social media tools actively and they're expected to learn about them as part of the curriculum, that so many of the conference venues at those places have sound systems that are locked down and bolted down in cages that are often many hundreds of feet away from the room where the sound system is feeding. So it's very difficult to tap into those. And, you know, you just have to be nimble.
Mm-hmm.
And having a husband who's a sound engineer probably is helpful.
It certainly has been over these 25 years, I can tell you that. And that's what I always think of him as, bag of tricks. You know, it's just, you got to sort of anticipate and be ready, and then you can pretty much troubleshoot anything. So I love that you said that.
Absolutely.
So what advice would you give to others? You know, I always say to entrepreneurs or people that are wanting to break out into their own thing, but if you want to even speak to, because I think it's appropriate for what we've talked about today, what advice would you give to someone who's sitting there thinking, I've always wanted to do a podcast, because obviously you hear this a lot, and, you know, where do I even begin? Maybe we should just speak to that entrepreneur that is saying, you know, I think I have something to say, I think I have something to share.
Well, I think it's a kind of a creative medium that anybody can get into. The barrier to entry is very low. You can begin podcasting probably with a laptop computer that's sitting in front of you right now by simply learning how to use the audio recording software that's typically installed on it already and the built-in microphone that's already there and play around with it. I will say that people who do podcasts because they just want to talk about things without having a topic or a mission or a vision, that maybe they may enjoy doing it as an avocation, as a hobby, but it may not get a lot of audience listening to it. If you have a topic and specific focused content that you go after in a very systematic way, you can build an audience for that content. And it generally works better if you have multiple voices rather than just one person talking at the audience. And it generally works better if you edit very judiciously. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons I got into podcasting was my wife had heard a very early feature on NPR about podcasting. And she said, boy, you know, with your radio background, you should be doing this. And I started listening more intensely to podcasts. And what I started hearing was stuff that reminded me, frankly, of how I and my friends sounded when we first started in college radio. And that is talking about things that the audience really doesn't care about, like the kind of microphone I'm using or the studio I'm sitting in or pushing the buttons on the control board. Nobody can see that and nobody really cares about that. What they care about is your content. And if you can make it sound knowledgeable and professional and like you know what you're doing, that's where you grow an audience. I think there are millions, literally millions of podcasts where people are having fun with their buds and talking and joking and laughing about things that the audience doesn't have a clue what they're talking about. And I don't think that really moves a needle if you want to move a needle for an entrepreneurial business or for your hobby or for making yourself an authority or an expert or a brand. I think what moves the needle there is demonstrating some expertise and knowledge and the ability to attract others with knowledge and expertise to talk to you. It's not that hard. There's lots of people out there who are more than willing to appear as a guest on your podcast. So that would be my advice, is make it professional, make it sound authoritative, and make it sound like you have a passion for what you're doing. Don't lose the passion, but also make it sound like you care about the audience.
Absolutely. And I know for us, we after about 6 months, I did a lot of surveys and just asked people, you know, what do you like about the show? What do you dislike about the show? What do you wish we would cover or that we're not covering? And people were very specific. And it helped me to be a better interviewer. And it helped me to dig a little deeper for the answer that I was looking for, or like, tell us about the journey. The one thing that came out of the surveys that we did is, I hate when people say I was broke, and then I could barely buy groceries, and then we did this, and we were making a seven-figure income. And it's like, no, there was more of a journey there than you just decided one day and then suddenly you're making a seven-figure income. But that is the story that is just told so often without a lot of detail or not a lot of information about the journey of what it took to get there or how you gained that expertise that you suddenly are this expert in this field. So I try to always at least try to get that from our guests so that our listeners can understand if they are interested in something, where might be a place to start or, you know, becoming, like you said, having good content or an expert in something before you just go out and think that you're going to, you know, talk about it or do it. So and it's interesting, though, but the surveys really were helpful to us to find out what people really enjoyed or didn't enjoy.
Yeah, it's surprising how people realize how hard it is to put together a talk show on a regular basis. It's not that easy to give people content that's going to be worth their listening. on a regular basis. There's a lot of preparation that's required, a lot of research, a lot of understanding of the topics that you're going to talk about. And it just requires a little bit more work than maybe people realize.
Mm-hmm.
They think, you know, podcasting is great. You just, you know, push the record button and talk.
Right.
And you can do that, but then you better be able to edit what you just recorded.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I can tell you we've had to edit a few things out. From barking.
Well, I promise not
dogs.
To be one of those.
No, you're not so far. We've had barking dogs. We've had phones ringing. I'm like, oh, let's turn that phone off.
The tipping point for me was I was listening to a podcast, and in the middle of the podcast, the person who was talking, who was an expert, really good expert in the field, suddenly stopped and said, "Sweetheart, please be quiet. I'm doing my podcast."
And they didn't edit that?
They didn't edit it out, and I don't know if they left it in. You know, there was an ethos early in podcasting where people said, oh, you should never edit. There's still some people around who say, we never edit anything. We sit down, we have a jam, we talk, and whatever we say, that's what goes in the podcast. Well, that's a recipe for a podcast nobody's going to listen to except you and your friends.
Right, exactly.
You know, because nobody understands the jokes. You know, there's just all the inside baseball stuff that goes on. Nobody cares about that.
Right. I always tell people that, too, at the beginning of when people do lives on Facebook, it's sort of the same thing. It's like nobody cares that you're sitting there waiting and, oh, I was doing this first and now let's wait. The people just ramble on to the point where at 15 seconds, people are like, I've heard nothing. I'm out of here. It's like,
yeah, exactly.
Got to be something. Well, this has been awesome. I appreciate so much all of the wisdom that you have shared today. So, what exciting things are you working on now that you think maybe our listeners could benefit from? And then how can people find you?
Well, one of our regular clients is a clergyman, a Jewish rabbi, who is an expert in how the issues that face the aging population intersect with issues of Jewish spirituality. And we've been doing his website and his podcasts for about, oh, I guess 10 or 12 years now. And we've gone back and forth. We've done a few videos in the past. Then we went back to podcasting. He had a radio show for a period of time, which was turned into podcasts. And now we've gone back full circle, and we are taking his weekly podcast, which is called Seekers of Meaning, and it's found on JewishSacredAging.com. His name is Rabbi Richard Address. He's a national expert on issues of aging, baby boomers dealing with elder care issues and all that kind of stuff, and growing old themselves. We've now gone full circle, and he comes in my studio a couple of times a month and records the podcasts. We're now doing them as videos as well as audio podcasts. So for me, the challenge is getting the video version produced and up takes a little bit more work than the audio version alone.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, getting that workflow set up and moving it along has been a bit of a challenge, but we've got them now and we're cranking them out.
Where are you repurposing those?
They appear on JewishSacredAging.com. They're also on, there's a YouTube playlist of all of his, but we try to bring back people back to the website to get the content. There's a tendency for people to say, oh, go to my YouTube channel and watch my videos. We try not to do that because, you know, once you send people to YouTube to watch a video, once they get bored, they start watching people whacking themselves with rubber chickens or, you know, cats meowing or whatever, mm-hmm. and you lose them completely. So keeping them on your website where they can see your video and see your other content, we think is a better choice. So we don't try to push those channels as much. We send people to the website. And then as for me, we have two websites that we work with primarily. The primary website is beingthemedia.com, where we showcase our corporate work in podcasts and video and corporate photography. And then we have the news website, which is statebroadcastnews.com. We just had a really cool opportunity. The Speaker of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, was in southern New Jersey over this past weekend campaigning for the local congressman, and we were able to attend that and cover it for video and produced a little video news story that you can see at statebroadcastnews.com. So that was kind of cool.
That is cool. Absolutely. It's always fun when you get opportunities like that, no matter what. It's just exciting to get to be part of those kinds of things. So
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for being our guest today. And again, sharing your pearls of wisdom and experience. And it's been very interesting. It's been interesting for me as well. So thanks, Steve. I appreciate it so much.
My pleasure. You're very kind, Belinda. Thanks.
And I just want to remind all of our listeners that if you want to continue to hear these really great interviews that cover just a broad spectrum of different entrepreneurs and different levels of expertise on all kinds of subjects, then subscribe to our show and you won't miss a single interview. So with that, I'll say thank you once again, and I hope you have a fantastic day.
Thanks for joining us at Work From Your Happy Place. If you like what you hear, please share it with your friends and be sure to rate and review us on iTunes or Stitcher. For a free gift on finding your own happy place, please visit workfromyourhappyplace.com and click on the free audio button. Thanks again for listening.